clothing is connected to our sexual expression. So, of course, advertising related to clothing, there's going to be a sexual connection forever, whether it's Calvin Klein, American Apparel, or brands that we haven't even contemplated. Every generation, there's going to be certain people that push boundaries. And those are my people. Lock me up already. I mean, it's obvious. Put me in a cage. I'll be fine. Okay? You know, I'm my own worst enemy. But what can you do? I was born strange.
He said American Apparel founder and CEO Dov Charney from an interview with Marketplace earlier this year. But first, what to do about Iraq? President Obama addressed the country today to talk about what the U.S. plans to do about the unraveling situation in the Middle East. Among other measures, the U.S. will send 300 military advisors to Iraq to help the country's security forces, but he won't send combat troops.
American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again. We do not have the ability to simply solve this problem by sending in tens of thousands of troops and committing the kinds of blood and treasure that has already been expended in Iraq. Ultimately, this is something that is going to have to be solved by the Iraqis.
The president has come under increased criticism lately for not doing more to stop the Sunni extremist group ISIS from taking over large sections of Iraq. Militants are threatening Baghdad and the largest oil refinery in the country. Joining us now to talk about the president's plans and reaction to them is Indira Lakshmanan, foreign policy correspondent for Bloomberg News. And welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Thank you for joining us. So what did you make of the president's remarks today?
Yeah, well, here in Washington, it's all that anyone is talking about, of course, because it's sort of a back to the future thing where we feel like we're back 10 years ago talking about Iraq and violence there again. Now, what the president laid out and tried to make very clear is that his number one priority is to protect Americans. So he has gone ahead and bolstered security at the embassy, and he said that he has moved around some staff. He also said that he significantly increased surveillance by the United States in Iraq. So that means intelligence, reconnaissance assets, that means manned and unmanned drones and surveillance to better know and understand what this Sunni-led terrorist group known as ISIL or ISIS, both ways, what they're doing, and continuing to support and increase support to the Iraqi security forces. And the big headline here is that President Obama said he's prepared to send up to 300 American military officials to Iraq to advise and train the forces there. But as you pointed out, he tried to make very clear this does not mean that they will be involved in combat or that there will be U.S. soldiers going back to combat in Iraq.
And just briefly, how, if at all, will this stem the march of ISIS or ISIS across Iraq?
Right. Well, I mean, this is a group that, as we know, has been growing in power over the last few years, I mean, both in Syria and in Iraq. And the main point is, as the president said, that by not having an inclusive government, the current government in Iraq is Shia-led and is seen by the Kurds and the Sunnis as not being inclusive enough, that has stemmed a lot of the discontent. Now, of course, that's different from terrorist activity, but it has allowed that the forces involved in the Iraqi security forces have not felt like they're part of a larger national force, is one of the things that President Obama said. And he said that that's one of the reasons that they were abandoning post and running away and not fighting back against ISIS, partly because they don't feel invested in a national, a nation state feeling. So a lot of what the president talked about also was trying to lead a diplomatic effort to work with Iraq and its leaders to try to have a more inclusive government and rising above those sectarian problems they have.
Well, given the president's measured response, will this do anything to quiet his critics?
Look, I think that at this point it's a real question of what can the U.S. do? Sending 300 advisors and trainers to Iraq is more than we had heard at the beginning of the week. Earlier we had heard up to 100, so this is an increase on that. Having surveillance is obviously supporting the Iraqi security forces so that they'll know what ISIS is doing, where they are, and how to combat them. But a large point that President Obama was trying to make was that he doesn't want to support one sect over the other. He doesn't want to be seen as supporting the Shia against the Sunni. Goonies. So in terms of what can it do, I think the U.S. has some serious national security interests there. It's not just the humanitarian interests, which are important ones of what happened to Iraqi people, but it's also the question of energy resources. I mean, Iraq, remember, is one of the major suppliers of oil through OPEC. And, you know, we heard reports that a refinery, that the biggest refinery in Iraq was taken over by ISIS militants today. So, you know, that's affected oil prices, and that affects, you know, global security in many ways. So to the extent that U.S. national interests or global security may be endangered, the president has already reserved the possibility of taking unilateral strikes or other military action.
What do you think the likelihood is, then, that the U.S. will get more involved?
I think at this point they're trying to keep it on a diplomatic plane. We know that Secretary of State John Kerry is going to be leaving shortly for a trip to the Middle East and Europe to try to work on, you know, diplomatic efforts. We know that on the ground in Baghdad, U.S. officials, diplomats, have been working with the government on elections that took place a couple of months ago. They're still supposed to be forming a government, choosing a new president, and then that president will have 30 days to choose a new prime minister. So they're trying to work on the constitutional process and hoping that if that goes along as planned, that that can, you know, again, create some national unity.
And again, just in the last 30 seconds, what ideas does the U.S. administration, the president's administration, have about Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and post Nouri al-Maliki?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think there's a lot of thinking that the president has probably lost confidence in Nouri al-Maliki, because he even said publicly that in the last 2 years that the sectarian divisions have gotten worse. And despite the U.S. prompting and prodding al-Maliki to try to have a more inclusive government. So I don't know what the prospects are for that changing. He said that any future leader would have to be better about an inclusive government. And the whole problem is, of course, you know, we don't have U.S. forces there for many reasons. The Iraqi government wanted us to leave. And so how much we can do is somewhat delimited by the Iraqi government itself.
Indira Lakshmanan is foreign policy correspondent for Bloomberg News. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
How do you feel about the U.S. involvement in Iraq? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRETS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW Press Play, and we might read your responses on the air. Well, the big business story of the day is American Apparel founder and CEO Dov Charney getting ousted by his own board of directors. Late last night, American Apparel's board announced that it's getting rid of Charney because of an ongoing misconduct investigation. It's not clear exactly what those misconduct allegations are or who's investigating them. But Charney has long been one of fashion's most controversial figures. He's been accused of sexually harassing his employees, choking a store manager, and holding meetings in his underwear, among other claims. Meanwhile, American Apparel's finances have faltered. Its share price has been below $1 since earlier this year, and now bankruptcy is a possibility. Still, when BuzzFeed business reporter Supna Maheshwari spoke to Charney for a profile a few months ago, he sounded bullish and confident about American Apparel's future and his own, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi there. What do we know about what happened since February when you last interviewed Charney and he sounded so confident that would prompt this coup by the board?
Right. So since I met with Dove, the company's finances have continued to deteriorate, and he had to sell some stock just to meet interest payments to his bondholders. A few rumors have swirled since then that the company's bondholders were getting frustrated and wanted a restructuring, but there's no reports or anything saying that there was tension between Dove and his board.
Oh, so it's a complete surprise for all of you in the business reporting world. Do you think it was as much of a surprise for Charney?
Absolutely. I mean, from what I'm hearing from various sources, it was a huge surprise for him. And the release itself, I mean, came out last night at 10:30 p.m. The meeting took place in New York, so it seemed very much a sudden decision.
And who's replacing him?
Pardon?
Who's replacing him?
That's the thing. On an interim basis, it will be the CFO, but they said they're searching for a permanent replacement.
And he's a very different type of character, right? This John Luttrell. There's nothing flamboyant about him. He's a retail industry veteran, as I understand.
Right. I mean, pretty much the opposite of Dov Charney, who is very flamboyant and, you know, full of personality.
Well, what is the connection, and this must be the $60 million question, between Charney's infamy and the lawsuits and his legal problems and the financial straits of American Apparel?
So it's hard to say. I mean, the word on the street right now is, of course, that there is an alleged misconduct cited. No one really knows what that misconduct was at this point, but the word is that it was tied to how he may have responded to certain lawsuits against the company right now. But the board was thin on details. A release last night didn't explain what had happened. So Charney has been a bit of a liability for the company for years and years, but at the same time, he's its founder and the creative director, essentially. So the company has always really turned an eye from his behavior and these harassment lawsuits, but something must have happened for them to be unable to do that anymore.
And can you just give us the 20-second rundown of all of those allegations and lawsuits and legal problems so we're caught up?
Sure. I mean, a bunch of them have been tied to wages and employment discrimination, but the bulk of them have really been sexual harassment lawsuits from former employees saying that, you know, he treated them inappropriately, that he behaved inappropriately in the office. And that's really been the bulk of them, I think, that have drawn the most headlines over the years.
Well, it's puzzling, isn't it? Today, American Apparel shares are up, it looks like. He's both a liability, but also his personality is so enmeshed with this brand. And these hypersexual billboards he created are probably the company's most famous or infamous calling card. So how are we to read this? To what extent is the sleazy sexual vibe and the infamy of Dov Charney part of American Apparel's appeal?
I mean, I think the two are so completely tied together. While he has been criticized for a lot of what he's done, I mean, the thing is his billboards and the photography, they're so iconic for the brand, and they've made it into a globally recognized brand. So I think it'll remain to be seen. I think that half the people out there believe that this will, you know, be maybe the end of some of American Apparel's sexiness and the iconic nature of the brand, whereas others are saying, you know, the brand is big enough now that it can survive without him. But only time will really tell.
Well, on the other hand, he has pursued what some would say are progressive, definitely progressive business practices. The company's manufacturing in downtown L.A., not shipping overseas, and his he was very outspoken about paying fair wages. So how do you assess his record as CEO?
I mean, that is tough to say because just even going to the factory and checking it out, he has provided a lot of jobs for people there. He treats those employees well, and given the concerns over manufacturing with Bangladesh, he's doing something right in that regard. At the same time, when you hear the complaints from former employees and some of the way he behaves in the office, you wonder about that too. So, I mean, I think it's hard to say, and you probably have a different perspective depending on what part of the company you work in.
Well, the latest is that this ouster might push American Apparel over the edge into bankruptcy. What are the odds on that?
That is tough to say. I mean, I think that's definitely a possibility. But at the same time, people have been talking about an American Apparel bankruptcy for years, and they've managed to squeak by even after their auditor resigned, even after they've lost multiple top-level executives. So I think they've always been able to scrape by without filing for bankruptcy, and without Dove there, this might be, you know, a renewed chance for them.
What did you think of him when you interviewed him?
I thought that he was very confident, and he was a really interesting person. His mind really jumps around from topic to topic. But when I asked him about succession planning and, you know, if he was grooming someone to replace him down the road, he was turned off by that question, and he bristled at the idea that he needed to even worry about succession planning. His idea was, you know, I'm just getting started. No one is coming here to try and kick me out, which is what made yesterday's news all the more surprising.
Well, even though you're a business reporter, maybe because you're a business reporter, when you were sitting across from him, did you feel it was your responsibility to get kind of a I don't know, a vibe from the guy?
To take the pulse
of, you know, he gets so much criticism for how he treats women, how he interacts with them.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't really address those concerns and kind of changed the subject. I think his view is he has a very kind of, wide-ranging views on sexuality and people, and kind of he made me feel like I was uptight maybe for asking some of those questions. He's very like freewheeling, really loose views, and
smart tactic probably on his part in a business interview. Well, here's another question: is there a bigger picture to this Charney story about the fashion industry at large and colorful CEOs? And I'm thinking they're eccentric people with vision and talent to build a brand, but they can become liabilities once the companies are successful. People like Abercrombie and Fitch CEO Mike Jeffries, right? Or Lululemon founder Chip Wilson.
Yeah, absolutely. You see it again and again in specialty retail with these brands. It definitely takes a certain kind of personality to pursue a vision, to build a brand, to make people fanatical over your brand. But then when it comes to running a public company and, you know, treating employees a certain way, a lot of these people falter. Mike Jeffries, of course, made headlines when his airplane manual was revealed and had these kind of insane instructions on how the men who work on it have to dress and look. And Chip Wilson, the Lululemon founder, came under a lot of criticism when he, you know, expressed certain views on the way women's bodies should look last fall. And the thing is, a lot of these people become successful because they lack a filter and because they say what they want to say. But when you're running a public company and you're responsible to shareholders and, you know, analysts are listening to what you're saying, suddenly it's a different ballgame.
Sapna Maheshwari is a business reporter for BuzzFeed. And thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks.
What do you think? Was it time for Dov Charney to go, or is it unfair to unseat a company founder? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook. Coming up, you just got 30 hours back in your life. The push to reduce FAFSA. That's the federal financial aid application. They want to make it just two questions. I can hear the sighs of relief from the whole nation if it were only true. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Madeline Brand. It's a rite of passage. It's the bane of families with kids applying to college. More than 20 million students are expected to fill out FAFSA this year. That's the free application for federal student aid. The form has a mere 108 questions spread over 10 dense pages. The real kicker, though, is the 72 pages of instructions. Now, two U.S. senators, Tennessee Republican Lamar Alexander and Michael Bennett, a Colorado Democrat, have proposed reducing the form to the length of a postcard. Imagine just two questions. How big is your family and what was its total income 2 years ago? Barmak Nasirian is director of policy analysis with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities in Washington, D.C. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
A postcard? Really? What are these two senators proposing?
Well, first of all, it is high time for us to revisit the application process for federal aid. No question, the FAFSA is a dreaded and terrifying form. Some of the most knowledgeable insiders to higher ed get tangled up in it, so I can only imagine what it's like for a family helping their kid or someone doing their own application, navigating the complexities of FAFSA.
The word nightmare comes to mind.
Yes,
also
it does.
Pulling my own eyeballs out. I mean, I just cannot. I cannot.
Oh, it's scary. It's
say it enough.
It's absolutely harder to fill out than the 1040 long form for many people.
Yeah. Now, why is the form so complicated in the first place?
Like everything else, there are vestigial reasons why various questions were included on the form. It's not utter craziness. When you dig hard enough, you see there are reasons why the form is the way it is. And the most important reason is that Congress controls the process by which aid is distributed. So
that says everything.
That says it all, doesn't it?
Right.
The component of the aid program we call need analysis, which is the means test for a benefit, is actually written into the statute so that the Department of Education doesn't even have regulatory authority to alter anything. And it is those specifications in law that tend to drive the form.
What do you think of this simplification then? What do you lose if you simplify it? Could you end up giving money to a family that doesn't really need it or miss families that do?
You could. Like everything else in life, you have absolute simplicity on one end of the continuum and extreme equity at the other end. So that the more questions you ask and the more information you have about applicants, the finer the calibrations and the distinctions you can make amongst different populations. And in many ways, that's what Congress wants. Congress wants to make sure that we don't see a headline tomorrow where a millionaire's son or daughter received Pell Grant because we never looked at their assets, for example. Now, you know, the notion of driving down the complexity of the form to a mere two questions is very appealing. It is, you know, what they're proposing is basically income and family size. But guess what? Two families could have identical incomes and identical family sizes, and one family could have $10 million in the bank, and the other one could have nothing. What's going to happen likely is that once an anecdote like that pops up, the next day Congress goes into action to refine need analysis and therefore the form to ask people about their assets, and then it keeps going on from there.
Well, we know that the government, and let alone all the web companies and retailers and who knows what, already know all about us through credit ratings and all these other sources. Is it really necessary to fill out this kind of form still?
Since
much of this information is already available if you just push a button.
This is quite correct. And in fact, while we ought to recognize the boldness of this proposal and its radical simplicity, which is sometimes what you need to jolt the system into recognizing its own irrational behavior. In some ways, it's sort of like Back to the Future. By the time you're talking about, quote-unquote, improving a system by still relying on a mail-in postcard. I mean, you know, who mails anything these days? You already sort of recognize how far behind the infrastructure for student aid really is compared to the rest of our economy. You know, I can walk into any car dealership here while I'm on travel even, and they can immediately do a quick look up on my, you know, credit score, and I can walk out of there, drive out of there in a new car.
Exactly. Well, that would have taken me 4 hours and 10 pages.
That's right. Well, that's the issue. I think we need to look past the system, this sort of paper-based mindset where people have to actively submit something in the mail or via the web and then wait for a while before an answer can be bounced back at them. I think we really need to move towards electronic infrastructure so that not only colleges, but more importantly, high schools can basically do on-the-spot lookups as part of their counseling, particularly of low-income kids, to make sure they know as early as 9th grade, 10th grade, that based on their circumstances, that they would be eligible for, say, a maximum Pell Grant today. That's, you know, better than $5,000. So that's the kind of motivation you could provide, particularly low-income kids, that college is possible for them, that they will have resources to attend.
Well, some critics say that offering a lot of student aid is enabling college tuition to be exorbitant, and it's even driving up the cost of higher education faster. How valid is that charge?
It partakes partially of some truth in the following sense. There is no doubt that particularly availability of easy credit, virtually unlimited amounts of easy credit.
Which is not what's on offer here.
Well, not here, but that's already current law. The fact is, believe it or not, a parent can borrow all the way up to cost of education with no cap, less any available aid today. So I mean, you know, and by the way, it's not a function of ability to repay. So you could be, you know, a family making a whopping 30 grand a year could actually borrow up to 60,000 bucks a year, 70,000 bucks a year if they can find the school expensive enough with enough cost of attendance issues for 4 years. Even though any rational observer would say, well, that's way too much borrowing in terms of the resources available to that family to repay the debt. So we do have a problem with easy credit, which has opened what I euphemistically describe as a path of least resistance for cost escalation. We need better price discipline. And in many ways, you know, addressing loan affordability is sort of missing the big picture. We need to make sure college is affordable. We need to address affordability of prices, not so much let prices go where they want to go and then just focus solely on making loans taken out to pay those prices more affordable.
Bar Magnasirian is Director of Policy Analysis with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities in Washington, D.C. I appreciate you taking the time away from your vacation to talk with us. Thank you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Just ahead, when animals go mad, how anxious dogs, compulsive parrots, and mad elephants help us understand ourselves. And that's after the news with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. In May 2003, Oliver decided that he just couldn't take it anymore. The constant panic attacks, isolation, crushing depression. It just wasn't worth it. And so Oliver jumped from his fourth floor apartment to the concrete below. Taking one's life is not unheard of for someone with problems such as Oliver's. But Oliver wasn't a man. He was a dog. Laurel Braitman's dog. And because of Oliver, Braitman set out to document the mental illnesses of animals and how our attitudes on the emotions of animals have evolved. Her new book is called Animal Madness: How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Laurel Braitman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's such a sad story. Tell us about your dog, Oliver. What led up to this fall from your apartment, and what happened next?
Well, the first 6 months after my ex-husband and I adopted him, he was a dream creature. He was affectionate and sweet. And then over time, his crippling anxiety began to show itself. And it was heartbreaking. We tried all kinds of things to help him. And in the end, we actually couldn't help him. He died in a panic. But at the same time, I just owe him everything. He really changed my whole view of the animal kingdom.
And he didn't actually die in that fall, right? He was around for another 2 years.
To our great shock. And in fact, he became a kind of wonder at the veterinary hospital, vet residents coming in to see him, because he fell, 55 feet onto cement, and he miraculously did not break a single bone. But the vet behaviorist told us that he needed to be on Prozac and Valium, which I found shocking at the time.
And this led you to look at how we view mental illness in animals and what it says about ourselves. And you visited a number of animal behavior clinics, including one at Tufts, where they diagnose animals with disorders like what Oliver had, I assume, separation anxiety, also extreme aggression, compulsive grooming. So how can they make a diagnosis since you can't really know what an animal is feeling?
Well, it's difficult. There's a lot of guesswork involved. What I was skeptical about in the beginning was, yes, you know, we diagnose humans usually verbally. We ask people about their symptoms. But we don't do that with children. And we actually don't do that even with a lot of adults who can't or won't speak to their therapist. And so much of psychotherapy is actually trying to understand the reasons we feel the way we do, which I found interesting and surprising. I mean, actually, most of us can't actually, without a lot of investigation, often with a therapist, say or explain why we're going through an emotional thunderstorm. And I think the same may be true with other animals. So literally for hundreds of years, we've diagnosed people without doing interviews. And I think we can use those same powers of observation when it comes to the animals around us, as long as we know what their version of normal is.
I think that's what's so interesting about your book. I came away from it with such an appreciation of how unique each animal is, just as human animals are unique. And you do tell quite a number of stories about elephants. That's a trope, the mad elephant. Could you tell us your favorite story of an elephant that suffered certain symptoms and how he was diagnosed?
Sure. I'll tell you a happy story because this one just almost makes me cry every time I think about it. I met two elephants who live in northern Thailand named Jokia and Maypirm. Let's see, they're probably about in their 60s now and they're best friends. They're never out of trunk reach of each other. But 20 years ago, maybe a little bit more, Jokia was working as a logging elephant and she had a really abusive owner. She was walking up a hill. She gave birth and her owner didn't let her stop as she was working. She was dragging logs. And the baby rolled down the hill still in its amniotic sac and it died. And she went into a deep depression and she refused to work. And to try and motivate her to work, the owner stabbed her eye out. And this is something that happens a lot with elephants in Thailand. And so I think he was thinking if he hurt her, she would become a little bit more submissive. But it didn't work. In fact, the opposite thing happened. She flat out refused to work and she became a very, very difficult elephant. Obviously, she was just depressed and upset
and traumatized.
Absolutely. A woman named Lek Chalert, who runs an elephant ecotourism and refuge style sanctuary in northern Thailand, adopted her. And within a few weeks, she began to come out of her shell a little bit, largely because of another female there, Maypirm, who had also been used in the logging industry, but had also been retired. And over time, the two of these elephants really brought each other back from the brink. They became social. They started to venture out further. They both started to eat more. And they became a really tight herd of two. And now Jokia is fully blind, but Maypirm leads her around everywhere and really watches out and takes care of her. So something that I found great about that story and so many others that I came across while researching this book was that oftentimes the best therapist for an animal isn't a person, it's another animal. And sometimes it's not even two animals of the same species.
Well, yeah, we know about horses like to have goats in their stalls, right? And that's a...
Absolutely.
Right, and companionship is also, is often so much of a therapeutic agent for animals. But as you say, what is psychotherapy for animals? Once that you arrive at a working diagnosis, what then?
It's as complicated for them as it is for us. And really, they need a cornucopia of options just like a suffering person does. That is exercise, sometimes psychopharmaceuticals, structure, being in a new, safe environment. Really, it depends on the individual. You know, what cheers up one dog or keeps them from an obsessive-compulsive disorder is not going to be the thing that helps another dog. And same with parrots or wombats or elephants.
Now, I think we have to say we're perhaps, or of course, we are anthropomorphizing here. And I suppose the question is, how much of what we're talking about is anthropomorphizing and how much is based on science?
Well, I actually don't think those are different things. I mean, anthropomorphism, or the projection of human desires, motivations, ideas onto other creatures, I actually think it's something that we need to embrace. I don't think we can avoid it, frankly. You know, we always will be one human being thinking about the experience of another animal. We can't take our brains out of our heads, put them in a jar, and use them to think about other animals.
And part of me agrees with that, but I guess I see two sides to anthropomorphizing. On one hand, it encourages us to have more empathy for animal suffering and to try to help them. On the other hand, it perhaps blinds us to what's really going on with them. And how would we know? So how does that double-handed theory square with with your research and your own beliefs about this?
Well, I think that we could anthropomorphize well, or we can anthropomorphize poorly. So I think, you know, putting your dog in a tutu because you think they like it is probably an example of doing it poorly.
that would be called projecting.
Exactly. You know, so I think we can, though, use the things that we have in common with other animals to better understand them. That's what I believe anthropomorphism is when done well.
We're speaking with Laurel Breitman. Her new book is called Animal Madness. Will you look into suicide, animal suicide? What's the thinking now on whether animals commit suicide, like your Oliver, for instance, or beached whales and dolphins?
Well, in Oliver's case, I actually think he was just in a panic, and he did what dogs and maybe some people do in a panic, which is that he tried to change his circumstance because he was so uncomfortable. And the only way he could see to do that was to jump out of the apartment. He was choosing a state away from his discomfort. And in that way, it's similar to some human suicides, where I think some people do kill themselves, not because it's premeditated, not because they've calculated the distance from the top of the bridge to the bottom, but because they feel so terrible, they need to change their momentary discomfort. And there's so much mystery, you know, to someone who overdosed, did they do it on purpose? Sometimes we don't know. For some animals who are definitely self-aware and intelligent, I think we have to extend to them the capacity that maybe they are capable of killing themselves. We can't prove it, but I think in a lot of ways that's beside the point.
Can you tell a specific story about a dolphin or a whale? Because you do talk to many trainers and they come down on different sides of the suicide issue.
Absolutely, absolutely. The ex-trainer, Rick O'Berry, who's a well-known animal rights activist, he believes that dolphins in particular can commit suicide. And he's convinced that Kathy, she was the dolphin actress who played Flipper. There were actually four different Flippers. She was one of the Flippers. And after the show ended, she was transferred to a tank off by herself, and Rick had left, and she was around new people and new other dolphins, and she fell into a deep depression. And by the time he was called and alerted that she wasn't doing well, and he went back to Florida to be with her, she was near death. And he says that as soon as she saw him, he hopped into the pool with her, and she swam into his arms, and then she stopped breathing. And he believes that she did it on purpose. And that's something that a number of people I spoke to talked about, which is that dolphins and whales, unlike us, where we breathe without thinking about it, they have to make a choice to breathe. And so it is actually easier for them to choose to stop breathing than it is for us. And normally that helps them because it allows them to dive deep distances and to stay under the water. But they can also use it to, I think, do themselves in.
Well, it is so hard to untangle how we feel about ourselves as humans and how we feel about animals. The way we think of mental illness in animals now, what does it say about how we've evolved then in our thinking on human mental illness?
Well, I hate to say it, but I'm not sure we've evolved all that much. You know, I don't know if I'm just a grumpy historian, but one thing that I found in all of this research, which really as far back in time as you can go with a lot of this stuff, every time there's been a human disorder, there's been this menagerie of animals who are also suffering from it. So, you know, in the 1890s, dogs and women could suffer from hysteria. At the turn of the century, you could die of heartbreak. Or during World War II, you could die of homesickness. And there were ducks dying of homesickness and gorillas dying of homesickness. And I think now what we're seeing, you know, is our cats and dogs and some of our zoo animals and other creatures are coming down with things that we see in ourselves very frequently, things like separation anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorders. And I'm not really sure how new this is, but I think that we just have new names for it. And a lot of them are on psychiatric drugs because that's how we're treating ourselves now. So really, animals have always been with us. And when we look at a history of mental illness in animals, we're basically looking at a history of mental illness in people.
Well, I want to go back to your dog, Oliver. And you say in the title of the book that animal mental illness is a way to learn about ourselves. So what did Oliver teach you about yourself?
Oh, Well, he challenged all of my assumptions about other animals. I mean, I would say going into this, I knew that other animals could have emotions, but I wouldn't say I was a rampant anthropomorphizer to the extent that I am now. And I really didn't think about other animals as individuals like I thought of other people. You know, my brother, for example, is a total adrenaline junkie. He's a firefighter, paramedic in Southern California. And he is definitely a very different animal than I am. And now, you know, near my studio, occasionally a deer runs across the road right in front of me. And I wonder, like, is this deer the equivalent of my brother? You know, are all deer timid, or is there a deer risk taker out there that relishes jumping out of helicopters? You know, I look at groups of pigeons and I wonder who's the timid one. I didn't do that before Oliver. It's made the whole world so much more interesting to me. It's also made me more compassionate. One thing that identifying mental illness and recovery in other animals does is that it helps us help them. So, you know, we're all embarrassed about our secret dog voices or the dumb nicknames we have for our animals that we say when no one's looking. But I actually think we should embrace those things because it helps us help the creatures around us.
Laurel Breitman, author of Animal Madness, How Anxious Dogs, Compulsive Parrots, and Elephants in Recovery Help Us Understand Ourselves. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Laurel Breitman will be talking about her book July 10th as part of the Aloud series at the Los Angeles Public Library. Warren Olney is here. And I
brought my psychology with me.
But not your psychotropic drugs for your pets?
No.
Fair enough.
We're going to be talking today about whistleblowers, and they may have interesting psychologies. I don't know. We're not talking about that. We're talking about whether we need them, whether there are too many of them or not enough. Is the government hiding information we need to know? And there's a billboard up now near the State Department advertising for whistleblowers with Daniel Ellsberg's picture on it saying, don't do what I did and wait too long, and there's a war.
Every one of those questions are pressing.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Fantastic. And that's coming up on To the Point. But first on our show, by the time our governor is done, he will have probably filled 3 out of the 7 chairs on California's highest court. Jerry Brown's supreme opportunity. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Madeline Brand. The highest court in California is about to undergo a major change. Supreme Court Justice Marvin Baxter announced yesterday that he won't seek re-election in November. In April, Joyce Kennard, the other longest-serving justice, announced that she won't come back to the court either. And Governor Brown replaced Justice Carlos Moreno, the only Latino on the court, with Goodwin Liu in 2011. This means the governor will most likely end up appointing 3 of the 7 justices. Emily Green is one of the reporters who covers the court for the Daily Journal. Hi, Emily.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the governor appoints justices to 12-year terms, and then they go up for re-election or retention. What has the court makeup been like in the last 12 years? And almost all of the justices were appointed by Republican governors, right?
Yes, the court has been almost exclusively Republican for the last 2 decades. For about the last 10 years, you've only had 1 Democratic appointee on the court. And so what we're really going to see is a transformative shift.
Well, remind us of some of the most significant decisions that the court has made in recent years before we get to talk of specific justices. And of course, I imagine upholding Prop 8 must be near the top of that list.
That's definitely been at the top of the list. Other big decisions in recent years, there was one that came out that said these bans on pot dispensaries that are going up all around California. I think more than 200 cities and municipalities have enacted bans on pot dispensaries. The court, in a unanimous decision, said those bans were lawful. More recently, and again in a unanimous decision, the court said that an undocumented immigrant could, in fact, become a lawyer. And this was really interesting, and it resonated with a lot of Californians, where immigration is a big issue, and where there are such problems and dysfunction in our immigration system. It's worth noting that the court has been pretty unanimous in almost all of its decisions, and there's been very little dissent. And one might chalk that up to the fact that many of the justices came from the same ideological ilk.
Well, I also wonder, the court is losing Marvin Baxter, who reportedly sounds like a bit of a peacemaker. He was the conservative leader. He sounds like kind of the glue of the court, also a workhorse. How significant a role did he play in keeping the court collegial and so productive and contributing to these unanimous decisions?
I do think that he was a peacemaker. In person, he was very gentle and very kind. I mean, anyone who met him, he just had a very affable personality, a little bit like a grandfather. And I think that he played a big role in keeping that court collegial. And I think he was also persuasive. I will say when there were divisions, he fell on the conservative side. And it's hard to say to what extent he played a role in keeping the court unanimous. I think that that might just be more a factor of the justices thinking alike.
But and that might change, right? Joyce Gaynard is leaving. She's known for being fiercely independent. So who are you anticipating might take the place of Baxter and Gaynard?
So far, the governor has been vetting, according to my sources, almost exclusively Latino candidates. And that's because right now on the court, there are no Latinos and there are no African Americans. Latinos make up about 30% of the population of California. So I think the Latino constituent is really gung-ho on getting a Latino on that court, and for good reason. They include federal district court judges. And that's interesting because they are Obama appointees. So essentially, he would be taking an Obama appointee from the federal court, potentially, and putting them on the state Supreme Court. There's also a Court of Appeal Justice in San Jose who's being heavily vetted. Also some law school deans, and they include Rachel Moran of UCLA and John Tresvina of UCSF. And I will note, just speaking to the unanimity, we've already seen some shakeup on this. And that's because Goodwin Liu, who was Governor Brown's first appointee to that court, since his appointment, we're seeing less unanimity. He's writing many separate decisions, a lot more dissents. Some of the dissents are quite biting and critical of the court's jurisprudence. So it's going to be very interesting to see what additional Brown appointees might do and in what direction the court might go.
Do you think the governor is considering any wild cards, given that he's near the end of his political career and he's not worried about losing votes or political currency?
I think he takes these appointments very seriously. And he made some big mistakes in his first governorship. He appointed a Berkeley law professor by the name of Rose Byrd to be the Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, and she was immensely controversial. She was very progressive. What I've heard is that personality-wise, she was somewhat caustic, and she angered both business interest and law enforcement. She also was famous for not upholding a single death penalty conviction. And ultimately, she was voted out of office along with two other Democrats. And that's the point at which we saw the total sea change in the makeup of the California Supreme Court. I don't think he wants a repeat of the Rose Byrd fiasco. So I would be surprised if it were a total wild card. I would say another candidate that's been thrown out there and that we might see given more serious consideration is a judge by the name of Jim Humes. And Jim Humes was Governor Brown's longtime and top advisor at the Attorney General's office and also at the governor's office. And he was appointed in late 2012 to the First District Court of Appeal in San Francisco. He's considered a Brown confidant, and he's also notably the first openly gay state court of appeal justice in California. So I think that Brown would perhaps love to make history by naming an openly gay justice to the California Supreme Court.
Emily Green covers the court for the Daily Journal. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much.
Jolie Myers.
I am here with the feedback, Barbara. And, well, we talked at the top of the show about Dov Charney. The American Apparel CEO is out. He was fired by the board. I wonder if they'll change their iconic ad campaign now that Dov Charney is gone.
Why do you wonder that? Of all things to wonder. Why? You think
well, that's one of the most controversial
things. Women with bruises on their legs and kind of...
Well, we know how Barbara comes down on the ad campaign. But I think we're about to get a glut of billboard real estate in Echo Park and Silver Lake. We'll
I
see.
Know. That's I would love to see art. That's
Replace
please.
It with something that that builds people up, perhaps. Well, he is a controversial figure, Dov Charney, and he has been over the years. So we asked our listeners to weigh in on his ouster. Nayla Safiari says on Facebook that the move is long overdue for such an unprofessional executive. Rhiannon Ellington says that now that Charney has been fired, she might actually consider shopping at American Apparel. So maybe they'll get a boost to their sales now that Charney is gone.
And at least they got a boost to their stock price.
Yep, that
too. I haven't checked it in the last hour, though. So
I know I am
coming
not...
at this from all sides.
I'm not interested in spending, you know, $60 on a hoodie, so... They still won't get my business. But Brian Vasquez says the story's not over. He says the board wouldn't have fired him if they didn't think something big was about to come to light. So we'll see about that. But Vanessa Bronson came to Dov Charney's defense. She was, I think, the only one on our Facebook conversation.
And a woman.
Vanessa is this person's
presumably,
name.
Presumably. Yes.
She says that she appreciates his unorthodox style. Hopefully the new leadership keeps Dov's framework for the company in place.
Normally, I'm always for unorthodox. So, yeah, as I said, you can go either way on this, but that is it for us for today on Dov Charney and everything else. If you do have thoughts about the show, we'd love to hear them. You can reach us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or we're on Twitter at KCRW Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in from Madeline Brand. See you tomorrow.